Chapter 20, A Second Overthrow of the Persians by the Romans. Now the emperor of the Romans dwelling in Constantinople, being fully aware that God had plainly given him the victory, was so benevolent that although those under him had been successful in war, nevertheless he desired to make peace, and to that end he dispatched Helion, a man in whom he placed the greatest confidence, with a commission to enter into a pacific treaty with the Persians. Helion having arrived in Mesopotamia, at the place where the Romans for their own security had formed a trench, sent before him as his deputy Maximin, an eloquent man who was the associate of Ardaberius, the commander-in-chief of the army, to make preliminary arrangements concerning the terms of peace. Maximin, on coming into the presence of the Persian king, said he had been sent to him on this matter, not by the Roman emperor, but by his generals, for he said this war was not even known to the emperor, and if known would be considered insignificant by him. And as the sovereign of Persia had gladly decided to receive the embassy, dash for his troops were suffering from want of provisions, dash there came to him that corps among them which is distinguished by the name of the Immortals. This is a body of brave men numbering about 10,000, and counseled the king not to listen to any overtures for peace, until they should have made an attack upon the Romans, who, they said, were now become extremely incautious. The king, approving their advice, ordered the ambassador to be imprisoned and a guard set over him, and permitted the mortals to put their design upon the Romans into execution. They therefore, on arriving at the place appointed, divided themselves into two bands, with a view to surround some portion of the Roman army. The Romans, observing but one body of Persians approaching them, prepared themselves to receive it, not having seen the other division, in consequence of their suddenly rushing forth to battle. But just as the engagement was about to commence, divine providence so ordered it, that another division of the Roman army under Procopius, a general, emerged from behind a certain hill and, perceiving their comrades in danger, attacked the Persians in the rear. Thus were they, who but a little before had surrounded the Romans, themselves encompassed. Having utterly destroyed these in a short time, the Romans turned upon those who broke forth from their ambuscade and in like manner slew every one of them with darts. In this way those who by the Persians were termed the Immortals were all of them shown to be mortal, Christ having executed this vengeance upon the Persians because they had shed the blood of so many of his pious worshippers. The king of the Persians, on being informed of the disaster, pretended to be ignorant of what had taken place, and ordered the embassy to be admitted, he thus addressing the ambassador, "I agree to the peace, not as yielding to the Romans, but to gratify you, whom I have found to be the most prudent of all the Romans." Thus was that war concluded which had been undertaken on account of the suffering Christians in Persia, under the consulate of the two Augusti, two being the 13th of Honorius, and the 10th of Theodosius, in the fourth year of the 300th Olympiad, and with it terminated the persecution which had been excited in Persia against the Christians. Chapter 21, Kind Treatment of the Persian Captives by Acacius, Bishop of Meda. A noble action of Acacius, Bishop of Meda, at that time greatly enhanced his reputation among all men. As the Roman soldiery would on no consideration restore to the Persian king the captives whom they had taken, these captives, about 7,000 in number, were being destroyed by famine and devastating Azazen, and this greatly distressed the king of the Persians. Then Acacius thought such a matter was by no means to be trifled with, having therefore assembled his clergy, he thus addressed them, "Our God, my brethren, needs neither dishes nor cups, for he neither eats nor drinks, nor is in want of anything. Since then, by the liberality of its faithful members the church possesses many vessels both of gold and silver, it behooves us to sell them, that by the money thus raised we may be able to redeem the prisoners and 50 also supply them with food." Having said these things and many others similar to these, he ordered the vessels to be melted down, and from the proceeds paid the soldiers a ransom for their captives, whom he supported for some time, and then furnishing them with what was needful for their journey, sent them back to their sovereign. This benevolence on the part of the excellent Acacius astonished the king of the Persians, as if, The Romans were accustomed to conquer their enemies as well by their beneficence in peace as their prowess in war. They say also that the Persian king wished that Acacius should come into his presence, that he might have the pleasure of beholding such a man, a wish which by the emperor Theodosius's order was soon gratified. So signal a victory having through divine favor been achieved by the Romans, many who were illustrious for their eloquence, wrote panegyrics in honor of the emperor, and recited them in public. The empress herself also composed a poem in heroic verse, for she had excellent literary taste. Being the daughter of Leontius the Athenian sophist, she had been instructed in every kind of learning by her father. Atticus the bishop had baptized her a little while previous to her marriage with the emperor, and had then given her the Christian name of Eudocia, one instead of her pagan one of Athenais. To many, as I have said, produced eulogiums on this occasion. Some, indeed, were stimulated by the desire of being noticed by the emperor, while others were anxious to display their talents to the masses, being unwilling that the attainments they had made by dint of great exertion should lie buried in obscurity. Chapter 22. Virtues of the Emperor Theodosius the Younger. But although I am neither eager for the notice of the emperor, nor wish to make an exhibition of my oratorical powers, yet have I felt it my duty to record plainly the singular virtues with which the emperor is endowed, for I am persuaded that silence concerning them, as they are so excellent, would be injustice to those who should come after us. In the first place then, this prince, though born and nurtured to empire, was neither stultified nor effeminated by the circumstances of his birth and education. He evinced so much prudence, that he appeared to those who conversed with him to have acquired wisdom from experience. Such was his fortitude in undergoing hardships, that he would courageously endure both heat and cold, fasting very frequently, especially on Wednesdays and Fridays. One and this he did from an earnest endeavor to observe with accuracy all the prescribed forms of the Christian religion. He rendered his palace little different from a monastery, for he, together with his sisters, rose early in the morning, and recited responsive hymns in praise of the deity. By this training he learned the holy scriptures by heart, and he would often discourse with the bishops on scriptural subjects, as if he had been an ordained priest of long standing. He was a more indefatigable collector of the sacred books and of the expositions which had been written on them, than even Ptolemy Philadelphus II had formerly been. In clemency and humanity he far surpassed all others. For the Emperor Julian, although he professed to be a philosopher, could not moderate his rage against the Antiochians who derided him, but inflicted upon Theodore the most agonizing tortures. 3. Theodosius, on the contrary, bidding farewell to Aristotle's syllogisms, exercised philosophy in deeds, by getting the mastery over anger, grief, and pleasure. Never has he revenged himself on any one by whom he has been injured, nor has anyone ever even seen him irritated. And when some of his most intimate friends once asked him why he never inflicted capital punishment upon offenders, his answer was, "Would that it were even possible to restore to life those that have died." To another making a similar inquiry he replied, "It is neither a great nor a difficult thing for a mortal to be put to death, but it is God only that can resuscitate by repentance a person that has once died." So habitually indeed did he practice mercy, that if any one were guilty and sentence of death was passed upon him, and he was conducted toward the place of execution, he was never suffered to reach the gates of the city before a pardon was issued, commanding his immediate return. Having once exhibited a show of hunting wild beasts in the amphitheatre at Constantinople, the people cried out, "Let one of the boldest bestiarii for encounter the enraged animal." But he said to them, "Do ye not know that we are wont to view these spectacles with feelings of humanity?" By this expression he instructed the people to be satisfied in future with shows of a less cruel description. His piety was such that he had a reverential regard for all who were consecrated to the service of God, and honored in an especial manner those whom he ascertained to be eminent for their sanctity of life. It is said that the bishop of Chebron V having died at Constantinople, the emperor expressed a wish to have his cassock of sackcloth of hair, which, although it was excessively filthy, he wore as a cloak, hoping that thus he should become a partaker in some degree of the sanctity of the deceased. In a certain year, during which the weather had been very tempestuous, he was obliged by the eagerness of the people to exhibit the usual sports in the hippodrome, and when the circus was filled with spectators, the violence of the storm increased, and there was a heavy fall of snow. Then the emperor made it very evident how his mind was affected towards God, for he caused the herald to make a proclamation to the people to this effect: "It is far better and fitter to desist from the show, and unite in common prayer to God, that we may be preserved unhurt from the impending storm." Scarcely had the herald executed his commission, when all the people, with the greatest joy, began with one accord to offer supplication and sing praises to God, so that the whole city became one vast congregation, and the emperor himself in official garments went into the midst of the multitude and commenced the hymns. Nor was he disappointed in his expectation, for the atmosphere began to resume its wonted serenity, and divine benevolence bestowed on all an abundant harvest, instead of an expected deficiency of corn. If at any time war was raised, like David he had recourse to God, knowing that he is the arbiter of battles, and by prayer brought them to a prosperous issue. At this point, therefore, I shall relate how a little after the war against the Persians, by placing his confidence in God, he vanquished the usurper John, after Honorius had died on the 15th of August, in the consulate of Asclepiodotus and Marian. 6. For I judge what then occurred worthy of mention, inasmuch as there happened to the emperor's generals who were dispatched against the tyrant, something analogous to what took place when the Israelites crossed the Red Sea under the guidance of Moses. These things, however, I shall set forth very briefly, leaving to others the numerous tales which would require a special treatise. Chapter 23. After the death of the Emperor Honorius, John usurps the sovereignty at Rome. He is destroyed through the prayers of Theodosius the Younger. When the Emperor Honorius died, Theodosius, now sole ruler, having received the news, concealed the truth as long as possible, misleading the people sometimes with one report, and then with another. But he privately dispatched a military force to Salani, a city of Dalmatia, that in the event of any revolutionary movement in the west there might be resources at hand to check it, and after making these provisional arrangements, he at length openly announced his uncle's death. In the meantime, John, the superintendent of the emperor's secretaries, one not content with the dignity to which he had already attained, seized upon the sovereign authority, and sent an embassy to the emperor Theodosius, requesting that he might be recognized as his colleague in the empire. But that prince first caused the ambassadors to be arrested, then sent off Ardaberius, the commander-in-chief of the army, who had greatly distinguished himself in the Persian War. To he, on arriving at Salani, set sail from thence for Aquileia. And he was fortunate as was thought, but fortune was adverse to him as it afterwards appeared. For a contrary wind having arisen, he was driven into the usurper's hand. The latter having seized him became more sanguine in his hope that the emperor would be induced by the urgency of the case to elect and proclaim him emperor, in order to preserve the life of his general-in-chief. And the emperor was in fact greatly distressed when he heard of it, as was also the army which had been sent against the usurper, lest Ardaberius should be subjected to evil treatment by the usurper. Asper, the son of Ardaberius, having learned that his father was in the usurper's power, and aware at the same time that the party of the rebels was strengthened by the accession of immense numbers of barbarians, knew not what course to pursue. Then again at this crisis the prayer of the pious emperor prevailed. For an angel of God, under the appearance of a shepherd, undertook the guidance of Asper and the troops which were with him, and led him through the lake near Ravenna, for in that city the usurper was then residing, and there detained the military chief. Now, no one had ever been known to have forded that lake before, but God then rendered it passable, which had hitherto been impassable. Having therefore crossed the lake, as if going over dry ground, they found the gates of the city open, and overpowered the usurper. This event afforded that most devout emperor an opportunity of giving a fresh demonstration of his piety towards God. For the news of the usurper's being destroyed Having arrived while he was engaged at the exhibition of the sports of the Hippodrome, he immediately said to the people, "Come now, if you please, let us leave these diversions, and proceed to the church to offer thanksgivings to God, whose hand has overthrown the usurper." Thus did he address them, and the spectacles were immediately forsaken and neglected, the people all passing out of the circus singing praises together with him, as with one heart and one voice. And arriving at the church, the whole city again became one congregation, and once in the church they passed the remainder of the day in these devotional exercises. Chapter 24, Valentinian, a son of Constantius and Placidia, aunt of Theodosius, is proclaimed emperor. After the usurper's death, the emperor Theodosius became very anxious as to whom he should proclaim emperor of the West. He had a cousin then very young named Valentinian, the son of his aunt Placidia, daughter of Theodosius the Great, and sister of the two Augusti Arcadius and Honorius, and of that Constantius who had been proclaimed emperor by Honorius I and had died after a short reign with him. This cousin he created Caesar, and sent into the western parts, committing the administration of affairs to his mother Placidia. He himself also hastened towards Italy, that he might in person both proclaim his cousin emperor, and also being present among them, endeavour to influence the natives and residents by his counsels not to submit to usurpers readily. But when he reached Thessalonica he was prevented from proceeding further by sickness. He therefore sent forward the imperial crown to his cousin by Helion the patrician, and he himself returned to Constantinople. But concerning these matters I deem the narrative here given sufficient. Chapter 25, Christian benevolence of Atticus, bishop of Constantinople. He registers John's name in the diptychs, his foreknowledge of his own death. Meanwhile Atticus the bishop caused the affairs of the church to flourish in an extraordinary manner, administering all things with prudence, and inciting the people to virtue by his instruction. Perceiving that the church was on the point of being divided inasmuch as the Johannites one assembled themselves apart, he ordered that mention of John should be made in the prayers, as was customary to be done of the other deceased to bishops, by which means he trusted that many would be induced to return to the church. And he was so liberal that he not only provided for the poor of his own parishes, but transmitted contributions to supply the wants and promote the comfort of the indigent in the neighboring cities also. On one occasion as he sent to Calliopius a presbyter of the church at Nicaea, 300 pieces 3 of gold, he also dispatched the following letter: "Atticus to Calliopius, salutations in the Lord. I have been informed that there are in your city 10,000 necessitous persons whose condition demands the compassion of the pious, and I say 10,000, designating their multitude rather than using the number precisely. As therefore I have received a sum of money from him, who with a bountiful hand is wont to supply faithful stewards, and since it happens that some are pressed by want, that those who have may be proved, who yet do not minister to the needy, take, my friend, these 300 pieces of gold, and dispose of them as you may think fit. It will be your care, I doubt not, to distribute to such as are ashamed to beg, and not to those who through life have sought to feed themselves at others' expense. In bestowing these alms make no distinction on religious grounds, but feed the hungry whether they agree with us in sentiment or not." Thus did Atticus consider even the poor who were at a distance from him. He labored also to abolish the superstitions of certain persons. For on being informed that those who had separated themselves from the Novatians, on account of the Jewish Passover, had transported the body of Sabatius IV from the island of Rhodes, for in that island he had died in exile, and having buried it, were accustomed to pray at his grave, he caused the body to be disinterred at night, and deposited in a private sepulchre, and those who had formerly paid their adorations at that place, on finding his tomb had been opened, ceased honouring the tomb thenceforth. Moreover, he manifested a great deal of taste in the application of names to places. To a port in the mouth of the Euxine Sea, anciently called Pharmacerus, 5 he gave the appellation of Therapia, 6 because he would not have a place where religious assemblies were held dishonored by an inauspicious name. Another place, a suburb of Constantinople, he termed Argyropolis, 7 for this reason. Chrysopolis 8 is an ancient port situated at the head of the Bosphorus, and is mentioned by several of the early writers, especially Strabo, Nicolaus Damascenus, and the illustrious Xenophon in the 6th book of his Anabasis of Cyrus, 9 and again in the 1st of his Hellenica 10 he says concerning it, that Alcibiades having walled it round, established a toll in it, for all who sailed out of Pontus were accustomed to pay tithes there. Atticus seeing the former place to be directly opposite to Chrysopolis, and very delightfully situated, declared that it was most fitting it should be called Argyropolis, and as soon as this was said it firmly established the name. Some persons having said to him that the Novatians ought not to be permitted to hold their assemblies within the cities, "Do you not know," he replied, "that they were fellow sufferers with us in the persecution under Constantius and Valens?" 11 Besides, said he, "they are witnesses to our creed, for although they separated from the church a long while ago, they have never introduced any innovations concerning the faith. Being once at Nicaea on account of the ordination of a bishop, and seeing there Asclepiades, bishop of the Novatians, then very aged, he asked him, 'How many years have you been a bishop?' When he was answered, 50 years, 'You are a happy man,' said he, 'to have had charge of so good a work 12 for such a length of time.' To the same Asclepiades he observed, 'I commend Novatus, but can by no means approve of the Novatians.' And when Asclepiades, surprised at this strange remark, said, 'What is the meaning of your remark, bishop?' Atticus gave him this reason for the distinction: "I approve of Novatus for refusing to commune with those who had sacrificed, for I myself would have done the same, but I cannot praise the Novatians, inasmuch as they exclude laymen from communion for very trivial offences." Asclepiades answered, "There are many other sins unto death, 13 as the scriptures term them, besides sacrificing to idols, on account of which even you excommunicate ecclesiastics only, but we laymen also, reserving to God alone the power of pardoning them." 14 Atticus had moreover a presentiment of his own death, for at his departure from Nicaea, he said to Calliopius, a presbyter of that place, "Hasten to Constantinople before autumn if you wish to see me again alive, for if you delay beyond that time, you will not find me surviving." Nor did he err in this prediction, for he died on the 10th of October, in the 21st year of his episcopate, under the 11th consulate of Theodosius, and the 1st of Valentinian Caesar. 15 The emperor Theodosius indeed, being then on his way from Thessalonica, did not reach Constantinople in time for his funeral, for Atticus had been consigned to the grave one day before the emperor's arrival. Not long afterwards, on the 23d of the same month, October, the young Valentinian was proclaimed Augustus. 16. Chapter 26. Sicinius is chosen to succeed Atticus. After the decease of Atticus, there arose a strong contest about the election of a successor, some proposing one person, and some another. One party, they say, was urgent in favor of a presbyter named Philip, another wished to promote Proclus, who was also a presbyter, but the general desire of the people was that the bishopric should be conferred on Sicinius. This person was also a presbyter but held no ecclesiastical office within the city, having been appointed to the sacred ministry in a church at Alar, a village in the suburbs of Constantinople. This village is situated across the harbour from the city, and in it from an ancient custom the whole population annually assembled for the celebration of our Saviour's ascension. All of the laity were warmly attached to the man because he was famous for his piety, and especially because he was diligent in the care of the poor even beyond his power. 1. The earnestness of the laity thus prevailed, and Sicinius was ordained on the 28th day of February, under the following consulate, which was the 12th of Theodosius, and the 2nd of Valentinian. To the presbyter Philip was so chagrined at the preference of another to himself, that he even introduced the subject into his Christian history, 3. Making some very censorious remarks, both about the person ordained and those who had ordained him, and much more severely on the laity, but he said such things as I cannot by any means commit to writing. Since I do not approve of his unadvised action in committing them to writing, I do not deem it unseasonable, however, to give some notice here of him and of his works. Chapter 27, Voluminous Productions of Philip, a Presbyter of Side. Philip was a native of Side. Side is a city of Pamphylia. From this place also Troilus the sophist came, to whom Philip boasted himself to be nearly related. He was a deacon and thus admitted to the privilege of familiar intercourse with John Chrysostom, the bishop. He labored assiduously in literature, and besides making very considerable literary attainments, formed an extensive collection of books in every branch of knowledge, affecting the Asiatic style. One, he became the author of many treatises, attempting among others a refutation of the Emperor Julian's treatises against the Christians, and compiled a Christian history, which he divided into 36 books. Each of these books occupied several volumes, so that they amounted altogether to nearly 1,000, and the mere argument two of each volume equaled in magnitude the volume itself. This composition he has entitled not an ecclesiastical, but a Christian history, and has grouped together in it abundance of very heterogeneous materials, wishing to show that he is not ignorant of philosophical and scientific learning, for it contains a medley of geometrical theorems, astronomical speculations, arithmetical calculations, and musical principles, with geographical delineations of islands, mountains, forests, and various other matters of little moment. By forcing such irrelevant details into connection with his subject, he has rendered his work a very loose production, useless alike, in my opinion, to the ignorant and the learned, for the illiterate are incapable of appreciating the loftiness of his diction, and such as are really competent to form a just estimate, condemn his wearisome tautology. But let every one exercise his own judgment concerning these books according to his taste. All I have to add is, that he has confounded the chronological order of the transactions he describes, for after having related what took place in the reign of the Emperor Theodosius, he immediately goes back to the times of the Bishop Athanasius, and this sort of thing he does frequently. But enough has been said of Philip. We must now mention what happened under the episcopate of Sicinius. Chapter 28, Proclus ordained bishop of Cyzicus by Sicinius, but rejected by the people. The bishop of Cyzicus having died, Sicinius ordained Proclus to the bishopric of that city, but while he was preparing to depart thither, the inhabitants anticipated him, by electing an ascetic named Dalmatius. This they did in disregard of a law which forbade their ordination of a bishop without the sanction of the bishop of Constantinople, but they pretended that this was a special privilege granted to Atticus personally. Proclus therefore continued destitute of the presidency over his own church, but acquired celebrity for his discourses in the churches of Constantinople. We shall however speak of him more particularly in an appropriate place. Sicinius, having survived his appointment to the bishopric by barely 2 entire years, was removed by death on the 24th of December, in the consulate of Hierius and Ardaberius. Two, for his temperance, integrity of life, and benignity to the poor, he was deservedly eminent. He was moreover singularly affable and guileless in disposition, and this rendered him rather averse to business, so that by men of active habits he was accounted indolent,